Welcome to Coffee House Shots, the Spectator's daily politics podcast. I'm Isabel Hardman and I'm joined by Katie Balls and James Forsyth. Well, it's the first day back in the Commons today, and unsurprisingly, Brexit is going to dominate the agenda. We're expecting a statement from Dominic Raab this afternoon on the Brexit negotiations over the summer. He'll be talking about how well he's been getting on with Michel Barnier. But we've discovered that Jacob Rees-Mogg feels he has quite a lot in common with the EU negotiator as well, Katie.
Yeah, this is quite an unlikely friendship in many respects, but it's strange that Chequers has actually managed to perhaps not unite the entire country, but probably about two-thirds of it, in their dislike of the deal. Various people dislike Theresa May's Brexit compromise for a number of reasons, from having too close a relationship to Europe to having too loose a relationship with Europe. But yesterday, one of the parliamentary groups that Jacob Rees-Mogg was a member of went to Brussels and they met with Barnier. And the arch-Brexiteer said they had a very positive meeting. I don't think it was positive for the Prime Minister, but it was positive for Jacob Rees-Mogg because he says both he and Barnier agree that Chequers is rubbish, I think are the words that Jacob used, and secondly, that they agree that it doesn't work and it'd be much better to have a free trade agreement or a much closer relationship. Now, I think it's quite clear that what Barnier and the Brussels side would like would be a much closer trading relationship. But it does underline this idea that Chequers appears to be the worst of both worlds.
James, what are we expecting from backbenchers in the Commons today when they respond to the Brexit Secretary?
I think there'll be quite a few questions along the lines of what Jacob Rees-Mogg said actually yesterday, because this, I think, is what has changed over the summer, is that there is now more scepticism over no deal. I think I think the return of Steve Baker to the backbenches has made people more wary of no deal, because I think he, having been involved in some of the planning in government, although he is not opposed to no deal, I think he's been quite clear with people that this would not be the walk in the park that some Tory Brexiteers had previously thought it would be. So if you don't like Chequers and if you don't like no deal, where do you go? Now, this is what makes yesterday's meeting so interesting, because what Michel Barnier is essentially saying is, look, the Canada offer is still on the table if you want it. And that is a problem for Theresa May, because a very large part of her party say, well, why not take that? What's wrong with that? That's just a free trade deal. That's what we want. So I think this is why yesterday's meeting was unhelpful for Theresa May, just as Parliament comes back, to have Tory MPs reminded that there is actually an alternative to Chequers on offer. Now, I think what Michel Barnier is trying to do is trying to push her further towards Norway, thinking that if you say, look, your choice is Canada or Norway, she'll pick Norway. Having been back for 48 hours, I don't think she's got the political room to move to Norway. So where do we go then?
Literally, obviously. Yeah. Although she might be tempted.
Yeah. And so the question we get into now is, what does she do? And I think it'll be very, very interesting to watch Dominic Raab at the dispatch box today, because this is not a man without ambition. And does he give any hint that while a deal may be negotiable, it may not be the deal that Theresa May is keenest on?
Katie, it sounds like cabinet tensions aren't exactly abating over this.
Yes, I think the cabinet, you could say, is more united than it was before Chequers in some respects, because Theresa May has lost some of the big Brexiteers in her cabinet. And that does mean that they're probably a little bit closer together, but we know that Liam Fox, for example, is someone who thinks no deal is something which could work, and also I think it's the person we suspect doesn't like Chequers because of what they argued for on Brexit. Then you have people like Jeremy Hunt, who tried to talk a big game on Brexit. I think at one point almost sounded Trumpian in some of their Brexit statements. But then more recently on, you know, this charm offensive across the EU capitals, seemed to be suggesting that no deal was the end of the world. Then about 3 hours later changing that because they'd realised it had gone too far. So I think the cabinet is still fairly confused on where they are, but I think what is clear is Chequers is becoming a harder thing to sell, and something I think some ministers with ambition will be questioning how closely associated they should be. And it's worth seeing who has actually gone out and battered for it directly, because some of the notable names that we talk about for leadership have actually done quite well to avoid that. I think
I also think one of the things that, now Katie will correct me, having manned the fort all summer when I go wrong here, but before the summer break, Downing Street wanted everyone to do every minister to do one day where they did a media round in which they defended Chequers. As far as I recall, that did not happen.
No, we were not treated to that over the long
so
summer.
So therefore, we have not had a kind of estimate they, for example, has not yet come out and, to use Katie's phrase, batted for Chequers, nor has Penny Mordaunt. You know, so all of this goes on. And I think this is the other question, which is, how long until, when is the first cabinet minister say, well, look, we tried with Chequers, that's not flying, so maybe it's time to change tack? I think that is a kind of interesting question.
And the mood has changed so much that the day, obviously, the weekend that it was announced, Michael Gove went on to the Andrew Marr show. He was criticised by many Brexiteers for this, and I think it did damage his standing amongst the Tory grassroots. He sat on that sofa and gave a very passionate defence of it. I would be interested to see if he would do that now, because I just think the mood music has changed so much that I think that would be a harder thing to get someone like that to do.
As one cabinet minister said to me, that at the Chequers, the argument, the principal argument made for Chequers was that it was negotiable. If it isn't negotiable, what are the merits of it? I mean, which is the problem which Number 10 are dealing with, which is, and so they this is why this Salzburg summit, where the EU27 will talk about, is so important, because they need to be able to say, ignore Michel Barnier, Angela Merkel and Emmanuel Macron, they like Chequers. So far, while they have been polite about Chequers, that there is no sign yet that they are doing it. I mean, the best that Theresa May's allies can point to is the polls saying, well, maybe people should be a bit more pragmatic and flexible. But given the status of Poland in the EU at the moment, that is not exactly going to decisively tilt the balance one way or the other.
Now, moving on to Labour, the party is debating whether to adopt the full definition of anti-Semitism this afternoon. Katie, how do you think that's going to go?
So today's the NEC meeting, and everyone expects them to adopt it. I think if they don't adopt it, it would be a big surprise. There would be scenes after that. I think there's talk that they might try and add a caveat or two. So I think all eyes will be on that. So I think they would adopt the full definition, but they would try and put in something there to say that, you know, you can still legitimately criticise Israel on these terms. I think, though, it's still this general idea that Jeremy Corbyn is on the back foot here. Most people think the reason they're going to adopt it is not because he sat by his desk and thought, oh, it's too late. I think it's loads around him that have decided enough is enough. But when it comes to the membership, we've had the election of the Labour NEC candidates yesterday, and the whole momentum slate, so the pro-Corbyn candidates got picked. One that was particularly notable was Peter Wilsman, who was the figure that Momentum disassociated themselves from, because it came out in a recording that this Corbyn ally had basically suggested lots of the anti-Semitism allegations were down to Trumpian Jewish supporters, and that person is now sitting on the committee.
James, where do the moderates, as they're called, go from these NEC results? It's very difficult for them to claim any sort of victory, even though some of them amusingly have.
I think it's very interesting when you look at Ian Warren, the kind of electoral strategist linked, I suppose, more to the right of the Labour Party than any other group. On his number crunching, he suggests that the kind of momentum back people got kind of 64% of the vote. And I think that is yet another reminder to the moderates that, you know, they ain't getting this party back anytime soon. You know, if they are those people who want to argue that you should stick around, you know, you are talking about you're not talking about sticking around until after the next election. You're talking about sticking around for a generation in the hope that it might change back. So I think that is the sticking point. I still think that we kind of wait to see what happens. I think there's a kind of there's an element a bit like David Davis's threat to resign that we all think, oh God, we've all heard this about the Labour moderates leaving the party. You know, it's never going to happen. And then it actually does happen. I think one of the things that appears to me to have changed over the summer is I think there is now over a 50% chance of a double-digit number of Labour MPs not having the Labour whip by Christmas.
Possibly before conference, Katie?
But I think there is talk that if this, you know, the NEC didn't make this decision, tomorrow the Parliamentary Labour Party meet up and they are having a vote, a symbolic vote, on whether or not they want to adopt it. The vote doesn't mean anything, really. And I think part of the trigger for the NEC having this meeting today, where it's on the agenda, is to stave off the threat of that, because if they don't accept it, and we still need that, you know, confirmed, then the PLP would have this vote, they would show that they rejected it, and you thought you might see a few people decide that that would be the springboard from which they announced that they were resigning the whip. I think that if they accept it, it won't solve the problem at all. I think it will be a very hollow victory, but I think it will probably mean that things don't escalate to that level over the next few days.
The mandatory reselection vote at conference is also another moment, because once that comes in, Corbyn isn't going to stop it, but if he, the fact he's choosing not to stop it will, I think, make more MPs think, well, I've got very little chance of surviving. So, you know, why not throw caution to the wind? I've got nothing to lose.
Finally, Katie, Sajid Javid is considering some big changes to stop and search. Just explain what's going on there.
So this is an interesting thing because Theresa May has always been very protective of the Home Office, having served there for a long time. It's a difficulty Amber Rudd encountered. But ever since Sajid Javid has arrived, he's really managed to make waves and actually put his own, you know, his own mark on it. And the latest, perhaps, Theresa May policy that he is changing is that police will be able to stop and search anyone suspected of carrying acid under new powers. So it's this idea that you're increasing stop and search. Theresa May prided on herself on not increasing stop and search. This is another sign that he is able to get things done that previous people haven't in that role. So is that a sign of his strength or Theresa May's weakness?
James, what are Sajid Javid's leadership ambitions?
Look, I think it is quite clear that Sajid Javid is one of the people who will stand when Theresa May steps down. He benefits from the fact that he fell so far out of favour with her. You know, there was probably almost no cabinet minister who was in more danger at the height of the May ascendancy than Sajid Javid. So he's not tainted by the May era. And as Home Secretary, he's done a very good job of basically reversing the May legacy. If you think that what ultimately cost Amber Rudd her job was that she was too hesitant to touch the things that Theresa May had done. And her big strategic error was not realising that Theresa May was so weak after the election went wrong that she could basically have done what she wanted to do and Theresa May couldn't have stopped her. So you're in this position now where, and it is painful for Theresa May, but she's in this position where the big promotions she's made recently, Sajid Javid and Dominic Raab, you know, she's had to promote the people that almost she most actively dislikes, because that was the only way to hold the party together. And I think, as Katie says, it shows the decline in Theresa May's power and control, but even in the department that she cares most about, she's having to accept policy changes that aren't what she would have done.
Thank you, James, and thank you, Katie. And you can listen to this podcast and all our other podcasts on the iTunes store. This one's called Coffee House Shots, and we have a special offer for our podcast listeners: 12 issues of The Spectator for £12, plus a free Spectator branded thermally insulated water bottle. Just go to spectator.co.uk/water. Thanks for listening.